tuning in. This is Henrik. I'm the host of Red Eyes Radio. If you tuned in to our live show this past Saturday, thank you for that. A big thanks to everyone who donated as well. We will be able to upgrade our cameras and acquire a number of other gadgets that we need to improve our broadcast and really restructure the signal flow and make things much more stable here in the studio. We have a lot to improve with the broadcast, obviously, and we're just getting things up and running. So it was good, I think, to do this marathon live show as a way to test and try things out and, of course, learn a lot along the way. Our goal is to start with a regular live broadcast for members once a week initially, and then we'll move on forward from there. Your donations, all of them, is going to be a massive help, so thank you so much again for that. If you didn't see our live show yet, we've put up an edited version of it on redicecreations.com/live or redicemembers.com/live. There you can also still donate to our efforts. The more we can get, the higher we can set the bar and improve things significantly. So if you didn't donate to the new TV show slash channel yet, please consider doing so and help us launch this thing with class. Also, thank you to everyone who bought one of our first ever t-shirts. They have been going fast, but we still have more left. And you can get an exclusive Red Ice t-shirt, an organic one made by Lana Zlama, by the way, at that very same live link, redicecreations.com/live. Also, our new website, redice.tv, is pretty much done. We're restructuring a few things behind the scenes, and then we'll just do a redirect from the current site, and you'll be able to enjoy the new site fully. So as you can probably imagine, with everything going on, we are a bit behind schedule this week, but we'll be able to catch up and get ahead by next week or so. So thank you for being patient on that while we pitch the tent in a new territory. On to today's program. Since we spoke about our past 10 years on the live show, we have a kind of a vintage show for you today. Our guest is Don Fotheringham. We were alerted to him through James Bowery that was on 314 late 2014. That was a really good show, by the way. Go check it out if you missed it, James Bowery. Don Fotheringham is the author of The President Makers, How Billionaires Control U.S. and Foreign Policy. He is also on the board of Freedom First Society, which I'll ask him about. We are going to talk about those who have, from the late 1800s and forward, been controlling American politics and world politics and what their goals truly are. We'll get into Trump late in the first hour and continue that discussion in the second hour, where we also run into some pretty big differences between us regarding the JQ. So stay tuned for that. Welcome, Don. Thank you so much for coming on Red Eyes Radio with us. It's great to have you here today. I hope you're having a good day where you are.
I am. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Absolutely. Well, I'm looking forward to this, diving into the book, The President Makers, How Billionaires Control U.S. and Foreign Policy, a great book that details much, really, of the type of activities, shall we say, that we've been talking about on this radio program for years, really. And it's a lot of material condensed, and I'm really looking forward to diving deep into, the meat of the book, if you will. But tell us first, if you don't mind, if there's anything you think our audience should know about you, if they're new to your work, and also, of course, how you ended up writing the book.
Mm-hmm. Okay. First of all, I'm a veteran of World War II. There aren't too many of those left around. And I was in the Marine Corps in the Pacific and in combat. When I returned to the United States, I discovered that many of the things we've been fighting for were being given away diplomatically and through foreign aid to not just our friends but also our enemies. And that disturbed me a little bit. It took me a long time to figure out what was going on. I was an avid anti-communist, thinking that initially that that's where the source of our problems was originating. In any case, I finally discovered that the enemy is within. That things, so many things were adverse to the welfare of the United States and to the American people and our allies overseas, that it could be much more than just happenstantial. And I came across a quote by James Forrestal, our Secretary of Defense, who was criticizing the diplomats that were coming back from the Soviet Union. And he said that if they were making mistakes simply on the basis of stupidity, he said occasionally they would make a mistake in our favor. And I thought that was pretty profound. He caught on. Forrestal caught on that it was being deliberately perpetrated. The destruction of the United States and of freedom everywhere was being undermined by those who covet power. And when I discovered that, then I realized that I had a job to do, and I've been working in the freedom battle ever since.
Which were the diplomats? I'm thinking of a couple of people that I remember went over to the Soviet Union and basically ended up praising it. I don't know if we're talking about the same people here.
Well, we probably are. As you probably know, FDR had quite a few communists in his administration, but perhaps the most prominent ones were Alger Hiss, Lachlan Curry, Harry Dexter White, Klaus Fuchs, who gave away our atomic secrets. In addition to those who were in the diplomatic service, former President Herbert Hoover made an extensive study of the communists in the Roosevelt administration, and those were unknown until just a few years ago. Someone dug into his archives and came up with an abundance of material showing how completely the administration was occupied, virtually dominated. FDR was dominated by communists surrounding him.
Well, wasn't there, Don, there was even, I mean, Harry Dexter White, he was even tried for treason when he worked in the, the Secretary of Treasury, right?
Yeah, he was one of them.
In the Treasury, I should say.
Yeah, one of the more prominent among them.
And he ended up working together, of course, with the man behind Keynesian economics, and they developed. I find this period very interesting, actually, because you're right. It was the administration was riddled with sympathizers to communism at the time, and they were tried for treason. And yet, it seems that they were kind of left to continue their work, pretty much.
Yeah, they got a slap on the hand and a little publicity to make to assuage the concerns of the public. I think that's about it.
It's remarkable. It's absolutely incredible. But what's your view then in terms of the, I mean, the Second World War? Did that change at all in terms of how this was fought and how consequently the major sacrifices that were made both by Americans and of course, Europeans, and then that this, to a certain extent, was just kind of handed away or dismantled after the war, right?
Well, yes. Needless to say, it was very difficult realization to come around to. It didn't happen overnight. It took me a long time. I was very loyal to the Commander-in-Chief, Roosevelt, and so were my buddies, my companions in the Marine Corps were very faithful, willing to die for our country if necessary, because we believed that we were fighting for our freedom and the freedom of our allies. So it was quite a shock to realize that, one of Roosevelt's, I believe it was his Secretary of State, who kind of blew the whistle on what took place prior to World War II, how they goaded the Japanese into making the attacks so that they could say that we were attacked rather than that we were the aggressor. And as long as they were able to reverse that psychologically, he could easily get a declaration of war. The objective of the war, I believe, and I have quite a bit of documentation on this in my book, is to change the social structure of a nation and the nations involved in war, have them so terrified over another war and over the cost of war that they would surrender their freedom to some kind of global organization that would promise to solve, to end all wars forever, and of course that was the United Nations was supposed to fill that role. So things began to come together in that way for me.
Yeah, let's talk a bit more about the book then and how that came together. And obviously you said you kind of went on a trail when you discovered really the foundation of the lies here that things had been built on. And when America started to get under attack, how did the book come together? Is it over a course of many years, or what happened?
Well, yeah, it's over the course of many years. It would be unfair of me to say that I figured it out. The first person to to really get to the bottom of our problems, at least the deliberate nature of the problem. There was a man by the name of Robert Welch, who was the founder of the John Birch Society. And when I began to read his material, I realized that this was not by accident, that there were powerful individuals who had great control over the media, over the educational system, who were brainwashing our children, and who were cultivating an attitude that would be receptive to globalism and socialism. So I didn't dream all that up. I wish I had it, but I didn't.
Well, the globalists, the globalists was dreaming this up.
I suppose so. Yeah.
Well, tell us a bit more about that and the, I guess the structure behind it. You mentioned, of course, the United Nations, which began as the League of Nations, and then it transformed into that. But this goes back much further than that, correct?
Yes, my book actually covers a little over a century, about 125 years, when things really began to take shape. It was in the 1890s that the very wealthy elite in America took possession of the newspapers and the news services of the country. The three most prominent individuals in this were the Rockefellers and the J.P. Morgans and Andrew Carnegie, those three individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've kind of used those three as the basis of my book, following their lives, their developments, their intentions forward to what we have today. It probably began further back than the 1890s, but what we're suffering today can be directly traced to the activities of these three individuals, and so I thought it would be more effective if I just began right around the end of that century.
Let's talk a bit more about these three, and let's begin with Andrew Carnegie. What can you tell us about him for people who don't really know that much about him?
Okay, well, Andrew Carnegie, as most people perceive him, was a great philanthropist. The Carnegie Music Hall and the libraries all over the United States and probably in other countries as well. He's very proud of that image, was very proud of that image during his lifetime. But unfortunately, he did not earn his money justly. The free enterprise system did not make him wealthy. He cheated the free enterprise system to gain his wealth, and I think that's a very significant point. He was very dishonest and very bright young man working for the Pennsylvania Railroad. He and his manager started building steel railroad bridges under a different company name and selling them to the company that they worked for. And then they got into the sleeping car business and started manufacturing them under a different name and selling. And so they were the they were the salesman and the purchasing agent both.
Right.
So Pennsylvania Railroad didn't make out too well on that deal, but. they cheated their way, Carnegie particularly cheated his way into the elite circles.
So he didn't have a family background of being kind of in with the old network, so to speak?
Not like J.P. Morgan did.
Right.
He was quite different. He didn't have much to begin with, but he had a lot of ambition, and he was very quick to recognize opportunities. He didn't have apparently not a strong religious background, because he didn't seem to have any moral compunctions as he stole from one company and another and merged them into his steel empire.
And he worked together with Henry Clay Frick. What can you say about him?
Well, Frick was a very successful manufacturer of coke, which, as you know, is essential to the high heat needed for melting iron and steel and so forth. And he took Carnegie took him in as a partner, mainly for the advantage of getting access to his coke. And turned out that Frick was a terrific manager, very bright young man, and was perfect to be associated with Carnegie. So between the two of them, they pulled off a few fast purchases. For example, when steel was initially, steel was very difficult to produce until the Bessemer project came along, which came out of England. And when that was discovered, their competition had it first, and they were really out racing them on making railroad tracks out of steel. And so they did a little propaganda campaign against the company that was producing those, convincing the customers, the railroads, that it was inferior, that they didn't have homogeneity or something like that. I think they just made up the word. And they succeeded in bluffing the railroads out of buying those rails. And then the company that was making them went broke, and they bought the whole facility at 10 cents on the dollar, and then proceeded to produce the same railroad tracks and the same production lines and just literally stole this company by bluff and bluster.
Wow. Yeah.
It was quite a thing, and I think that people needed to know that. And because these are the three individuals who later on merged into a conspiracy.
Right.
And
exactly. We'll get to that. Tell us just briefly about, I have never heard about this before, but the Pinkerton Guards. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a strike at the Homestead plant, which Carnegie bought during its labor difficulties because the owners were so fed up they really wanted to get rid of the company. And so Carnegie bought it really cheap, like he does everything else, promising to reward the, to meet the labor's demands, which he did not have no intention of doing. And so when things became really reached a peak where his labor were on strike and threatening to damage the facilities, Frick ordered in the Pinkerton Guards, which was a private, actually a private police force, or you might call it a private army, in order to protect the plant, because he couldn't with any, he would need some more than just ordinary police to do that. And it turned violent, and there were deaths. Meanwhile, Carnegie had exited the country. He was over in Ireland, I believe, hiding there, pretending like he didn't have a phone or anything until all the trouble was over. Then he came back as a great hero and laid everything on Frick.
Oh, really?
So he really, you know, had no loyalty to his friends. The man who, his boss who got him started, Scott was his name, I think, had made some bad investments some 20 years later when Carnegie was at his peak of his income, and he wired Carnegie for some help, and Carnegie told him, I can't afford to save your sinking ship, and he really brushed him off. And this is a guy that initially loaned Carnegie $200 to buy stock in the sleeping car business. So anyway, and then he didn't treat Frick very well. He fired Frick, and fortunately Frick had no sense to go to court, and he came out getting his money back that he invested with Carnegie.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, says quite a bit.
Yeah.
So, of course, we had, I don't know what the score is with the Rockefellers and, the founder, if you will, of that dynasty, whatever you want to call it, John D. Rockefeller. But I've heard that they started at some process, maybe it's some, one of his sons later, but that in the way that they were involved in the train industry was that they started buying it up to later kind of decommission much of it to focus on automobiles as opposed to the train industry. I don't know if there's any connection at that point between Carnegie and Rockefeller.
Well, Rockefeller may have done that later, but I wasn't aware of that. It would be certainly characteristic of the way he operates, but I didn't know that. I only studied their the roots of these three individuals, how they obtained their fortune, and then later on, as the text progresses, I show how they're using that power to buy influence in government and to influence the thinking of the American people.
Yep. No, because he was behind Standard Oil, right?
Well, yeah, Rockefeller was. He was Standard Oil. That was the original name of this company.
Yep.
And his association with the railroads was very unique because he was getting kickbacks from the railroad on his oil shipments. He worked his way up into a large volume of production by buying his competitors, buying the other oil companies. And this way, the amount of product that he was shipping was significant enough that the railroads would give him a discount, but not anyone else. It was obviously cheaper to ship long quantities for long distances than to deal with short, a barrel of oil here, a barrel over here, where he'd make many stops and many deliveries. So he had an advantage there, and he created that advantage with that in mind. And he virtually ran his competition out of business with that railroad shipping discount.
Interesting. What else should we know about Rockefeller and some of the early days of him?
Rockefeller is an enigma. He to me, had I read his childhood story, I say he's not a prospect for a great fortune. But he was brought up in a home virtually without a father. His father was always gone somewhere, and no one
wasn't. He literally a snake oil salesman. His dad.
Well, now I think you've hit the nail on the head there. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he was some kind of a fast pitch artist that was always running from the law and never home, always somewhere else. So young John B. didn't have too many advantages, but he did learn how to save his money, and he worked hard. He worked on adjoining farms. They were out in the country. And his mother was very religious. She was a Baptist, and he was brought up in that faith and learned to pay a tithing. So, you know, the roots there are pretty wholesome. When he got into business, he started putting two and two together and figured out, well, you know, I don't have to do this the way everyone else does. And he learned to consolidate and build volume, and then build his fortune on the power of the volume of his production. Very, very shrewd, I had a Tarbell's book about him and Standard Oil, and she sees him as a very quiet, meditative, reflective type person. He was not a public person at all. Everything was behind the desk and behind the pen and the arithmetic. He spent hours and hours trying to figure out how to gain a penny here and a penny there.
Hmm. Do you recall who there was a mentor involved that kind of was starting to teach John D. Rockefeller? I believe he was a pastor or something. Do you recall what his name was?
He did have a pastor associate. I don't know if I used his name in the book or not, but there was a pastor. I believe he was, might have been... I don't know if he's Baptist or not. He may have been Baptist, but he did have a pastor who was very influential with him, and he finally took him in as a partner, and I think he corrupted the pastor. From then on, it was more dollars than Jesus.
Right. Yep.
So I can't really tell you the whole story. That's just my reflection on that.
Right. All right. Well, what else should we know about Rockefeller before we move on and speak a bit about Morgan?
Well, he amassed a huge fortune, with probably the greatest fortune in the United States at that time, just at the turn of the century, around 1900. He was the first billionaire of record anyway, And I think the strange part of it is that he always attributed his success to God. He said, God gave me my money. But my difficulty with that is that God has other purposes for human life on earth. And he claims that his monopoly smoothed out the wrinkles in the free market system, that it was superior to that. And then he used that fortune that he, once again, he also cheated the free enterprise system. If it wasn't, if he couldn't control it from the well to the cash register, he wouldn't do business. You wanted right. the whole thing. So
yeah.
That's how he became a multimillionaire. And then when the automobile came out, so up until this time, up to about 1800, it was mostly kerosene. When the automobile came out, his refineries were easily converted to gasoline. And then he was already had a foot in the door on the production of gasoline. And that was, that's when things really began to soar for the Rockefellers. And they used their money eventually to buy power rather than possessions.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep. Influence. Okay. Well, we're going to see when all these kind of begin to merge and what happens at that point. But let's just touch upon John Pierpont Morgan as well, the founder of Chase Bank, mm-hmm. Chase Manhattan Bank, that's still around today, of course. What can you say about him?
Yeah. Well, I have to be a little bit sympathetic. When you study the lives of these guys, you gain a little more understanding of why they were the way they were. He was a slow learner. He was not a good student. He didn't like school. But of course, his father wanted him to be well educated and expected him to take over the finance business when his father died. But anyway, JP was born with a great fortune. Could do anything he wanted in the world with the money that he had and the money that his father had. And until he was about 20 or so, maybe older than that, in his 20s, he finally grew up. Up until that time, he was wasting his time and his father's time and wasting his money and suffering some romantic disappointments in his life.
He grew up to the son of a millionaire, so which kind of a maybe rich, spoiled brat. Who knows?
Right? Yeah, and he probably was. He probably was a spoiled brat.
Yeah.
And his father didn't really have much hope of him taking charge of the world of high finance. But he suddenly, almost overnight, realized that he did have a gift. Academically, he was on the bottom level in every subject except arithmetic. And he had a head for math, and he applied it. He applied it to begin with in very petty ways, manipulating markets to make a few thousand dollars here and a few thousand dollars here. He thought it was pretty bright, and his father was disgusted with him. His father showed, look, he said, I just made a deal. I just made $5 million. You know, why don't you join me and do things the way I tell you to do it? So
right.
He gave up some of his petty schemes and became a very competent, very capable banking and stock expert.
Now, his father, I think is an interesting note, had a kind of a partnership with, through another man, George Peabody, to the Rothschilds, I believe, over in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were connected. Yeah, they did a lot of business with the Rothschilds. How deep that connection was, I didn't know. I didn't go into that deeply, but I thought it was an interesting connection because the Rothschilds financed governments and banks and large corporations, and it was pretty much the same pattern in the J.P. Morgan company. So I presume that they saw what could be done in actually getting governments in debt to them both for the power and the profit. And I believe that Rothschilds had a lot to do with that.
What were some of the unscrupulous things going on here? I think you talk about one event where they were basically behind weapons dealings, I think, during the Civil War.
Yeah, this is really ridiculous. His son, J.P. Jr., we're not talking about the Pierpont right now, but the J.P. Morgan, who became the co-conspirator here, found that some rejected weapons were stored in a government warehouse. And he bought them from the government. The government was getting rid of them. They said these are defective weapons, but they were selling them to the public for $3 a piece, carbines. And so he bought the whole warehouse full and sold them back to the army as, you know, as if they were
top grade. Yeah,
still functioning. Top grade, yeah. Right. Uh-huh. So anyway, that was pretty bad. He didn't seem to have any qualms about doing that.
No, it was a lot of money in war, right? So in some cases, they even antagonized the sides to be able to make some money out of the deal.
Yeah. Later on, they played both sides of the wars. But this little incident is kind of... I put it in the book because I thought it was kind of an indication of the character that would later develop and scheming type of maneuvers.
Exactly. All right, well, tell us when this kind of converged, when these three influential men kind of, you know, come together, and what are some of the driving intentions behind their plans?
Yeah, okay. Now, this is the hardest part of the book, Henrik, because no one's ever done that. There's a lot of grassroots material in this book. Someone would tell me, well, you know, the Morgans and the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds, Carnegies became a conspiracy together. They worked together. It was very difficult to find where they joined forces. And fortunately, I had some old books. In fact, most of this book is written from old books. It's not online data. So anyway, in my chapter, Marching Together, I found some of the authors, for example, John T. Flynn, whom I had known, I'd read his stuff before, was familiar with how they got together. Initially, they were rivals, arch rivals. They hated each other, and they stayed out of each other's way. But they had so many interlocking interests that eventually they came together, and they realized it would be to their advantage financially not to fight each other, but to pool their resources. And this is what brought them together. Whether there was any other plans for global power at that time, I don't really know. But I've done a chapter on how they got together and how their coordinated plan to control the wealth of the world came together. It was a very important part of the book because I haven't seen that anywhere in any other, anyone even speculate on how that came about.
So tell us a bit more about what you found and what the proof of this is. If there are paper trail or trusts or companies that start working together, or how did they interface with each other here?
Well, I am not that much of a scholar, Henrik, or a mathematician or a stock expert. All I've done here is go by the works of those who are on the scene. Ferdinand Lundberg was a stock expert who wrote for the Wall Street Journal and for the New York Tribune back in the World War I days and later. And he was a meticulous researcher. So much so that before I wrote this book, I was so impressed with the details that I went through his bibliography and I ordered 100 old books that were the ones I could find that were still in print, because that brought me in firsthand contact with people who were on the scene of the events I wanted to talk about. So the present makers isn't something that I got off the internet. It was old hard copy work, and Lundberg explained how these three guys got together. He said that initially it was financial, but when he realized that they had more money than they could ever spend, more money than anyone in the world would ever want, then he said he realized that there was something deeper, and that they were after power rather than dollars. And from then on, they started loaning money to countries in order to get them indebted to them. They began to buy politicians who would be prone to their war machinations and their attempts to bring about conditions that would cause the government to have to borrow money. And they were behind the scheme to bring about the Federal Reserve System. They actually designed the plan following pretty much the Rothschild's pattern. So anyway, that's what I got from Lundberg. And so far, I haven't found any place where he was wrong.
Yeah, where are the Rothschilds in this picture, too? I've heard that they've amassed just an incredible wealth over the generations, and that they are very deeply tied in, of course, to this same elite that we're talking about here. Was there any competition at some point, you think, or is this do they very much kind of align up on the same page at some point here?
I don't think there's any competition. And I think the Rothschilds, mainly, they had their clients, mostly Europe, European countries, and the Rockefellers and J.P. Morgans had the United States. But they had stock on the global market, and they were supreme stock brokers, and they did a lot of exchanging back and forth. But they learned the ropes from the Rothschilds.
Yeah, I can imagine.
They learned that you get governments in debt, excuse me.
Yeah. Yeah, but there's many examples of where the Rothschilds are behind, for example, crashing the Bank of England and of course, amassing even more wealth when it eventually recovers, etc. They know how to do this, but... I think it was Morgan who studied the Central Bank of England in London,
mm-hmm.
and they,
that's right.
You know, before
mm-hmm.
they really set up very much the same system in America. So where are mm-hmm. we around in the what year period are we in right now when we're speaking about this?
Early 1900, I believe. I think young J.P. Morgan, his father sent him to England to study the Bank of England about 1900, and he returned it about 1906 and or 1907.
Mm-hmm.
That was the period of time we're talking about.
And then finally, when is it again that the Federal Reserve comes into fruition? Is it 33, or was it earlier than that, right?
It came in 1917.
17, so not too long after that then, in other words.
No, not too long after that. The J.P. Morgan did a wonderful stunt, played a wonderful game of creating the conditions under which the American people would accept the Federal Reserve. He created the bank panic of 1907. His son got back just in time to see that, so I kind of had a feeling that his son was also in on this. But, it was artificial. The bank panic of 1907 was deliberately created by their power over the press. J.P. Morgan used the newspapers that he owned to announce that one of the major trust companies had gone broke, which they had not, and created a a rush of people rushing to the bank to recover their savings before they lost it all. And then he just parlayed that into real failures and artificial failures, both in the corporate world and in the banking world, and used that to prove to the people, you see, we see these terrible things happen. You've lost all this money, and you lost your savings, and we need some stability, and therefore we need this Federal Reserve System. That was a marvelous scheme. I have a chapter on that. And plenty of documentation that this is what they actually did deliberately. There were some federal investigations following that revealed a lot that I have in my book.
Yeah, I want to speak more about that. Well, one point I want to ask you a bit more about first, though, is about what we're talking about here is central banking, big money, massive amounts of money, capitalism, the so-called free market and whatnot. But obviously in the book, you juxtapose this with other political ideologies that are on the rise at the time behind the scenes. I mean, in the early 1900s, we, of course, have the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia in 1917. What's the tie-in between these two factions, and how are they using these seemingly two opposing forces?
Well, the insiders, I call them, that's the J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller financial organizations, they financed the Bolshevik Revolution. They financed it. Woodrow Wilson sent his diplomats over there with money and aid and comfort, and ordered the army not to interfere with the revolution. Incredible.
What was the incentives for that? What was the reasons for that?
Well, Wilson never had to explain anything. He just did it. I don't think the public knew until years later when some of the heirs of the insiders explained where that money came from. It was $20 million, I believe, from Jacob Schiff, who initially financed it, and that was sent over in person by one of Wilson's diplomats. Wilson didn't have to answer for a lot. He's still heralded as a hero, you know, in American textbooks and colleges. Wilson was bad news, but he escaped everything except his very dying days. I think he had some regrets, and I've got that in my book, some insights that I got from other authors who knew a little bit more about Wilson.
Was he, because obviously he was one of the bought and paid for politicians, but what did he reveal at the end?
I'm not saying that he revealed anything other than in his conduct. For example, his advisor, Edward Mandel House, was planted there by the conspiracy. House virtually lived in the White House. He was regarded as Wilson's alter ego, and just as an advisor. No one, the media, I shouldn't say the media, the newspapers, which is all we had then, the medium, never exposed House. They played him up as a very wise man that the president trusted. And actually, he was the pipeline between the conspiracy and the president. Edward Mandel House was instrumental in getting us into World War I, which Wilson had no intention of doing whatsoever. Neither did anyone in the United States. We didn't see that as anything that involved the Americans. But I believe that Wilson had some guilt toward the end, because he totally rebuked House. He kicked House out, saying, you know, I'm through with you.
Mm-hmm.
They had a little argument, and my translation of the argument is that House said to him, you are, you know, they were over in France, they were working on the Treaty of Versailles. And Wilson was taking some liberties that Hausa didn't think he should take, and Hausa was taking liberties that Wilson didn't think he should take. And Wilson said, I'm in charge now. I said, no, you're not. If it wasn't for me, you wouldn't even be president. And I believe that's what happened. Now, I don't have too many conjectures in my book, but that's one, because that conjecture, it fits with everything that ensued. His wife wouldn't even let House in at the funeral, at Wilson's funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And so House went back into his retreat and became the number one advisor to FDR.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So that's about all I could tell you about that. And once again, I have primary sources in my book. These are primary hard copy sources. They are not necessarily my conclusions. They are the conclusions of people who are on the scene.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's important.
Sure.
And I believe I have something exceptional here. I believe the book will, in time, make its way into far greater circulation. It'll never be in the New York Times bestseller list. I'll guarantee you that.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Not exactly our friend.
No. Well, I want to speak more in the media, I think, specifically in the second hour. This is such a huge subject in itself. But I want to, before we take a break here in a few minutes, I want to make sure as well that the audience get a good idea of the main kind of overview idea of what you're trying to convey in the book, right? Tell us a bit more about what the conspiracy really is about and how this is. I mean, obviously, there's a difference in how it was formulating then and how it plays out today, so it might be difficult to go mm-hmm. through all of it, you know, in a short segment. We can save a bit of how this manifests itself in current times later. But tell us what the nature of the conspiracy is and what it's about.
It's about power and control. Nothing new about that. It goes back to the nature of the human being. A bad man by nature covets power and recognition and has pride and wants to be, well, when he's given power, he tends to take unfair advantage of others. And that power comes through the political process. So they try to utilize the political process for their personal power and prosperity and importance. That is the best way I can describe conspiracy. It's an extremely difficult subject. I found that out early on after being rebuffed and kicked out of the best company. A very difficult topic. And
because you wrote the book?
That's why I wrote the book.
Right.
I wrote the book because it is so difficult. And what I've done in the book is something that the other authors have not done, which I think is important. Most people who are fighting the conspiracy and who are well-informed and want their readers to understand where they're coming from, they have it right up front. On the very first page, there is a conspiracy, and I'm going to tell you about it. I decided in the Present Makers, I would let the reader come to that conclusion. I don't put a keep out sign on the front page of my book like these other guys do. I have written the book in such a way, I'm building the history up to the point where these three individuals eventually took over the world and are accountable for almost all of the problems we face today. And I conclude the book with the solution that was offered by Madison and Hamilton and Mason, George Washington. They did have a solution. So it's not a doomsday essay. It's a tough story. It's a hard story. It's not a doomsday story.
What else would you say in the final few minutes here to those who doubt that such a conspiracy exists and think that it's more, I mean, you said that it's about, you know, human nature in that regard and the quest for power and domination, that's nothing new, but that it could be, well, let me say this. I think many people have a misconception both of the word conspiracy, what it really means, and also that somehow just because you say this, it implies that everything, every single event, every little nuance of what is taking place in the world is controlled, you know, by this conspiracy or those who are conspiring. But that's not my conception of the of that idea. It's more that it exists and an agenda, an idea that is agreed upon by X amount of people, and they are working towards enforcing that in the world. And in some regards, they are going to be able to control the game. In others, they are not. There are going to be unknown variables. There are going to be known variables. But, you know, that's kind of how I would explain it to someone maybe who doubts these things. But what would you say?
Well, I would follow the same explanation. One of the greatest mistakes that we make is when the nouveau conspiracy buff comes along, he tends to attribute every little drop of a gnat to the conspiracy, and all they do is give the conspiracy a chance to laugh at us. So I avoid that, and I think you've described it very well. They work on the salient points. They work on what counts. And they're not afraid to take two steps backwards. They're not afraid to retreat. As a matter of fact, at the present time, I see them in retreat, which is very interesting. It has been a strategy from the beginning. I think it came from Lenin, something like two steps forward and one step back, something like that. They know that strategy. And they are not afraid to back off, and they're not in a hurry because they're getting their pay every day. People who work for the conspiracy are paid well, and they live well, and they get their no good books reviewed in the New York Times. And so they're not in a hurry, and they don't have to win this overnight because they win along the way. They prosper along the way. So,
they think long term. They think long term.
Extremely long term.
Yeah.
Right now they are so upset over Donald Trump they don't know what to do.
I was just going to ask you, right, that the title is "The President Makers: How Billionaires Control U.S. and Foreign Policy." So, how do you view the presidential race today when a billionaire is running for president? Right. I mean, ironically, I think.
Okay, that's a wonderful question. It's a wonderful question. It is something they did not expect. They did not expect another billionaire to undo their 100-year progress in dismantling the United States. Their purpose is to reduce the United States to third world status, and here comes along a guy who I believe sincerely wants to make America great again. And I think they are in a total tizzy over Trump. They did not expect that. Here's a guy, they don't have to loan him any money. He can finance his own campaign. So when he comes out of this, whatever he is, he won't owe the insiders anything.
Yeah. Interesting, huh?
It is fascinating.
I think, I shouldn't say never. Never say never. But at least in a long, long time, there's never been such an honest candidate. There is simply just kind of seems to be really just almost to a certain extent winging it as he goes. I'm not saying that he doesn't have a strategy or whatnot, but I think the erratic speeches to a certain extent and the kind of the scatterbrain in terms of some of the points that he talks about in his rallies and all these kinds of things is kind of evident to a certain extent that he's just going along with the flow. And he's trying to make the best of the situation, you know?
That's right. No one has written his script. That's not a script. And it has been 84 years since we've had a real president in the White House. Harding and Coolidge were fantastic. The encyclopedias rate them as the worst presidents in history. They were the best we've ever had. Talking about the media. They brought the unemployment down to the lowest level ever. I have a graph on that in my book. I have a chart on that. And they brought the GNP up to the highest level ever. FDR never broached anything that those two men did. But they were not under the control of the conspiracy. they were their own men, and I see Trump as another Coolidge and Harding.
All right. Very interesting. You know what? I have much more to ask you about when it comes to Trump, when it comes to the media, and I guess addressing even a level of the continuation of the conspiracy through Trump, potentially. I've heard other people mention that. I want to get your take on that. But first, tell us about your website a bit. I don't know if it's your personal one, of course. I think it's more of an organization, Freedom First Society, and then also tell us where people can get a copy of the book.
Okay, Freedom First Society is not my organization. I'm on the board of directors, which is pretty perfunctory. I don't run the organization or have anything to say about how it's run. I do some writing for the website, and that is freedomfirstsociety.org. That is extremely valuable to anyone who wants to know what's happening in Washington, because you can pull up the name of any senator or congressman and find out how he's done on the important bills, whether within the framework of the Constitution or not. And so that would be valuable to anyone who wants that information. What is particularly special about the Freedom First report card on Congress is that they don't compare Democrats, Republicans, Republicans, Democrats, because that would give you a broad distance. It would make a Republican look better than he actually is. So what they do, they only grade Republicans against Republicans and Democrats against Democrats, which is
right.
a different tack than most of them take on that. My book is available at Amazon.com, and you can get from Freedom First directly if you prefer. You can get wholesale copies, which a lot of people are buying them by the case, and that's where we're making some progress. People love the book. If they love the book, they buy them by the case and make sure they get them to their friends all over the country.
When was it released, by the way?
2 years ago.
2 years ago. Okay.
Yeah.
Has it been doing okay?
Yeah, it has been doing okay. It's not a publish on demand book. We printed a large quantity so that as we go on our speaking tours, we go around the country, and as Freedom First speakers go around, they take a supply of books with them and sell them at the speeches, and that's been our best means of distribution.
All right, very good. We're going to have links up, of course, ladies and gentlemen, as we do, to the Amazon page where you can pick up a copy of the book. It's a paperback, and, of course, we'll have links to freedomfirstsociety.org as well. But, yeah, we'll take a short break here, and then we'll continue with Don Fotheringham in the second hour. So stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've been around for a long, long year. So many a man sold his faith. I was around when Jesus Christ had his moments of doubt and pain. Made damn sure the pilot washed his hands and sealed his fate. Pleased to meet you. Hope you guess my name. But what's puzzling you is the nature of my game. Stuck around St. Petersburg when I saw it was a time for change. Killed the Tsar and his ministers. Anastasia screamed in vain. I rode a tank in the generous rank when the blitz free rage and the bodies stank. Pleased to meet you. Hope you guess my name. Oh yeah. I was buzzing you with the nature of my game. Oh yeah. I was the glee. For the God save me, I shouted out.
The first hour with Don Fotheringham. The second one is coming up at redeyesmembers.com. We talk about the media, Trump, and what level of ethnic interest and hence ideological difference those within the elite hold that are Jewish, as opposed to the old Gentile guard that many today of the SJWs and many within the alternative for years have been blaming for everything that is wrong with the world. This idea that it's only old white men or WASPs that control America and the world, and that there really isn't anything more to discover there. I view things very differently than Don here, and he also has a religious overtone that I've not put into the picture. But it's good to hear different views and match them up against each other, so we'll hear what Don has to say about this. Tune in to the second hour at redeyesmembers.com. You can go there to get your hands on a membership if you haven't already and support our efforts and help us to build the new TV show as we move into a new phase of an independent media that will actually talk about the issues that matter. Stay with us, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be right back with the second hour after this break.